You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Brookings Institution. I'm Chuck Call. I'm a non-resident senior fellow here in the Latin America program and a professor at American University. Thanks for coming out on a miserable day. Wish we had the fire going here. I'm going to briefly introduce our panel, and in the order that they will be speaking on AMLO's first year, Mexico's political, economic, and security trends. To my left are... Our first speaker is Ambassador Roberta Jacobson. She's a senior advisor at the Albright-Stonebridge Group. She was is a former ambassador to Mexico, was the first civil servant in the history of the State Department to be a regional assistant secretary, and I first met her in the early 1990s when she was the deputy director of the Central America office, and I was working on Central America. To her left, Vonda Felbaugh-Brown is a senior fellow here in the Foreign Policy Program, and master of all things transnational and criminal in her writings, stemming from Afghanistan to Mexico to Colombia and other places. I'm sure you've read her work. And she has been in Mexico recently. And following her is Samantha Gross, who is a fellow here in the Energy, Security, and Climate Initiative at Brookings. She worked at the Department of Energy and has worked for over 20 years on issues of climate and energy. And will be speaking to us about those issues. And finally, Ambassador Earl Anthony Wayne, Tony Wayne, who is a public policy fellow and advisory board co-chair of the Mexico Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center. He preceded Roberta Jacobson as the ambassador in Mexico, retiring as a career ambassador from the State Department when he left, and is currently a distinguished diplomat in residence at my school, the School of International Service at American University. So, welcome to everyone. We're going to basically have very brief interventions, and then I'll go back and ask a few more questions, and then we will open up to the audience for some Q&A, okay? And so, initially, Roberta is going to share some of her reflections, and we'll begin with that.
Thanks, Chuck. Thanks for reminding me how long we've known each other, which...
You were 8 years old at the time.
Well, I usually tell people I entered the State Department at 12 since I left after 31 years. But I will also say that I'm also deeply grateful you didn't read the whole bio because, as people in Washington know, the longer your bio, it doesn't mean you're more distinguished. It just means you're older. We're coming to the end of what seems like an extremely long and very studied period of President Andrés Manuel López Obrador's first year. There's been a whole lot written, a whole lot said, and so in some respects it's hard to say anything that's different than things that have been said or published in the last couple of weeks. So I will try and do a little bit of that at a very superficial level, and then we'll hope to get into more depth as we go forward. There's a couple of things I want to say at the outset to frame my view of this first year of AMLO. One is a question that I sometimes wonder, which is, you know, is the question of, well, it's not as bad as it could be, the same as good enough? Because that's a lot of what you hear from people. We thought it might be worse. It's not as bad as it could be. For someone who had a ringing mandate, which really was pretty extraordinary when he was elected, I'm not sure that that's good enough, as I say. The second thing that surprises me consistently is how many people are surprised by what AMLO is doing. While his government is disorganized and often incompetent, he is fundamentally doing what he promised. And therefore, I think it reflects the extraordinary amount of wishful thinking that was going on during the campaign that he might govern differently than he campaigned. And that includes, and I think this is a really important point, attacks on institutions and weakening of institutions within Mexico because he is, again, fundamentally not an institutionalist. He's a solo actor. He's the decider. And therefore, institutions, whether those are checks and balances such as separation of powers or independent regulatory bodies or civil society, including media and non-governmental organizations, are obstacles to his agenda. And then the final thing I'll note, and I'm not going to talk about the bilateral relationship because others will do that, is that overall I think, a la Mark Twain, reports of the relationship's death are greatly exaggerated. It is a relationship that survives, albeit slightly beaten and bruised. My favorite of the analysis recently, the analyses that I've seen from Mexican firms or individuals, was one that compared his first year to Dante's Inferno. And what they did was they divided out things that you could categorize as infierno, or the inferno, failures, things you can categorize as achievements or cielo, heaven, and then those things that were in purgatory. I think most of us can agree that USMCA, although it's agreement, it's the agreement that will lead to ratification in the United States, came after his one-year anniversary. That is a significant achievement. Continuing fiscal discipline and independence of the central bank, an increase in the minimum wage. There are some bright spots, if you will, on the economy. The biggest area of social of achievement, I think, again, going back to the idea that he is what he promised, are the social benefits and assistance programs, which he's carrying out as he planned, as he said he would. I think in communications, it's been very interesting to watch the mañaneras. I think the figure for the first year, the morning news conferences, the figure for the first year of morning news conferences was 250. He held 250 of those. And what that successfully did, whether you like watching those every day or not, and I suspect his cabinet has a view about that, is that he sets the communications agenda for the day. And by doing them as often as he does, that means he has virtually set the communications agenda for his entire first year. People talk about what he talked about that morning. I think we could look at the issue of, you know, anti-corruption and taking on the huachicoleros, the gasoline thieves and so forth, and some judicial processes against people. But I think on the whole, I would not put the anti-corruption agenda in the area of achievements or success, which is interesting considering that was, some might argue, the fundamental reason he was elected. And mostly I would say that's, again, because Mexico has set up a series of laws that make up its national anti-corruption system, and he has not focused on that because he's not about building institutions and putting in place the structures that will carry out corruption. He's about, you know, sort of bringing charges against the huachicoleros or making sure Rosario Robles goes to jail. And those may not be bad things in an anti-corruption fight, but they're not going to strengthen structures and institutions that are separate from the president. We can talk a little bit about migration at some point, but I think it's questionable as to whether that's a failure or an achievement, and I'll explain why. It's clearly the case that the numbers are down from Central America going through Mexico because of Mexico's actions to ensure that that number went down, as well as draconian policies in the United States. But politically, there's a real question as to whether that long-term is an achievement. It is obviously seen by some in Mexico as having caved excessively to U.S. demands. I think there is a significant percentage of Mexicans who were not thrilled with the ongoing migration numbers either. But as long as his approval rating remains as it does, hovering near 60%, I think that doesn't create major problems for him. I would point out that from the beginning, that is the first day that he took office, when I think he had an approval rating of about 62%, to the end 1 year later, when he had 58%, with, you know, significant increases during and decreases during that period, that is a remarkably similar level at the end of 1 year. on failures, I think that we're going to talk about a number of those. I think you'd have to say at the top of that list are both the economy and corruption, a growth rate that will be either zero or slightly negative after two or three quarters of negative growth will certainly be difficult and a headwind for this administration. I think the question of when his promises and his programs come into conflict with fiscal discipline, i.e. when you can cut the bureaucracy no more, since he's cut it back to the bone, and find savings any place, I think that's a real serious problem for this government. And it's not clear to me that fiscal discipline doesn't get thrown out the window. And that's been a very important stability factor for the Mexican economy. And on security, Vaughn is much more of an expert than I am, but my uninformed view would be there is no policy on security. I'm the first to admit that some previous strategies have failed, but it is always better, in my opinion, to have a strategy than not to have a strategy, and I just don't see one right now. So it's hard to cooperate when neither side, in my opinion, on this, the U.S. or Mexico, has a security policy. Let me close by talking about a couple of things that are in purgatory. That is to say, they are pending, and the jury's still out as to whether they will be successes or failures at the end of his administration. One is the National Guard. For all intents and purposes, there is no National Guard. There's an entity that is made up of at least three different entities, the Army, the Navy, and the police, who've put armbands on their arms to say that they're National Guard. But it's not clear that there's training or doctrine or a real cohesive spirit within a new organization, nor that that organization is capable of battling the security challenges in Mexico as you divert significant numbers of them, not overwhelming, but significant numbers of them to work on migration issues. In his program, in his three big priorities, the Dos Bocas refinery, the Tren Maya, and the Transísmico, I think the jury's still out as to whether those will proceed. That clearly he is committed to proceeding on all of those, but they are varying degrees, I would say, of feasibility, from unlikely to impossible, and it's not clear that those are going to happen. If you had to evaluate López Obrador's foreign policy for his first year, it would be the shortest chapter ever, because he's neither interested in foreign policy nor does he believe it important, with the exception of believing that keeping a positive relationship with the United States is a number one priority. And we have seen that demonstrated over and over. And whether you agree or disagree with that, I think he has been extremely adept maintaining that relationship through difficult periods. And I guess finally, I would say, overall, if you had to get caps made for the López Obrador administration, they would probably say, make Pemex great again. And I'm not sure that's going to actually get Mexico to where it needs to be, because my belief is that his diagnosis of what was wrong in Mexico was very, very accurate, and that it needed fundamental change, but that his policies may prove to be counterproductive.
Thank you, Roberta. I'm going to come back with a couple more questions, but before I move on to Vonda, let me just ask you one right now, which is this. So, he's got a popularity rating of, you said 58%. I saw 68% about a month ago at the first year, roughly. But, I mean, that's a popularity rating that's higher than Trump's, than Boris Johnson's, than Macron's, than Bolsonaro's, not than Modi's. Modi's like maybe comparable. But so what? And yet almost everyone agrees that his performance has been disappointing in lots of areas. What explains, you mentioned the communication strategy, but what explains that, if you don't mind?
Well, I do think the communication strategy is part of it. We certainly see leaders who are adept at communicating their successes, even if many in the sort of chattering class, if you will, think, well, X is not a success, but it is defined by the president as a success and often perceived as such by the public. But I think overall, the biggest explainer of López Obrador's popularity is discussed with everybody else. That is the traditional political parties and those that came before. And so that hasn't worn off yet, right? He's being given not just 1 year, but longer, being given the benefit of the doubt because they don't see any alternative. They didn't in the election, and they still don't. And because he's pretty successfully defined the failures, the things he has been unable to do, as someone else's fault, right? That someone else may be his predecessor. It may be the Fifi and the elite. It may be, you know, whoever, those who are corrupt. But so far, he's been pretty successful at defining the things he hasn't gotten done as having been blocked by somebody else who doesn't want the best for the Mexican people. I don't know whether that will last forever, but I think that it was clearly durable beyond a year. I will say that I think the Achilles heel is security. I think security is becoming the kind of issue for more Mexicans than it ever was. And unless you can do something about that, I think it may very well begin to sort of dent that Teflon quality. But so far, I think people are willing to give it a little bit longer. I really do. That's just part of it is no other option.
Thank you. Very good. The homicide rate is on track this year to be the highest in modern history, higher than last year's record rate, higher than the levels that people thought were just alarming in the Calderon administration. And this is, for those of us who work on security, we've seen a lot of criticism of security policies of the past in Mexico. And now you have a leftist, particularly from the left, and now we have a leftist president who comes in and has a chance to articulate what a leftist security policy would be, with lots of high expectations and lots of studies that were done by lots of our favorite experts. And how's that going? Vonda.
Well, inspired by Roberta's Dante analogy, I'm often inspired by Roberta. I think there is the only adjective that can be applied to the security situation is hellish. And yes, there are countries in Central America, as you Czech know well, as Roberta knows well, that have greater homicide rates, but that doesn't excuse the fact that the security situation continues to be catastrophic. AMLO did inherit the country with very bad security trends, not simply in terms of the homicide rates, but really in terms of the profound failure and lack of adjustments that the country has been experiencing in security policy, despite a lot of very hard work having gone to police reform, particularly at the federal police reform level. So, you know, when he took over the country, there were really no trends, no structural tools, no indications that he would inherit anything other than a very bad security situation. And so from the very beginning, the ambition that his administration laid out, promising that by 2021 he would reduce the homicide rates from the national 20 per 100,000 to 4 per 100,000 was unrealistic. Now, he still has 2 years. Maybe a miracle will strike. I'll be delighted to be proven wrong, because it's not good for the people of Mexico, it's not good for our neighbor or for ourselves that the security situation continues to be bad. But right now, the only way that any significant reduction in homicides would come about is through the same set of developments that homicide rates came down at the end of the Calderon administration, the beginning of the Peña Nieto administration, namely through the actions of the criminal groups themselves. At the time, homicide rates came down because a set of criminal groups, Sinaloa cartel, one of them, Gulf, won enough stability in territories. But the security policies had not matured at the time to strengthen the deterrence capacity of law enforcement, both the police, various police forces, and the military. And so one or two presidents later, we are essentially at the same situation. The deterrence capacity of law enforcement in Mexico continues to be extremely low to non-existent. And as a result, levels of insecurity or security come at the hands of the discretion of the narco groups and their capacities. And with a much more fragmented market, much more fragmented criminal market, that was the case at the beginning of the Calderon administration, and the bipolar war that we see between the Sinaloa cartel and cartel Jalisco Nueva Generacion, spreading really all the way from Mexico into Colombia and essentially really spreading across the hemisphere. There is very little light in this hellish situation to shine onto to provide some way out of one of the circles of hell to purgatory. Now, where I, however, think that it's more than really bad structural situation, that there is a lot of blame to be actually laid at the hands of the Admiral administration, is at the choice of policies. And particularly, really, it's the abdication of fundamental responsibility to deliver law enforcement. And this goes back, Chuck, to your opening statement that many wanted to see a leftist security policy. AMLO is delivering a leftist security policy. During his campaign and since he became president, AMLO has had sort of two slogans or two overarching thoughts on how to deliver security. Hugs, not bullets, is one of them. Namely, and he frequently uses the phrase that we cannot fight fire with fire. And the second element is that he has wanted to back away from law enforcement strategies, particularly high-value targeting, but overall law enforcement strategies, and design security policy as addressing root causes. So delivering socioeconomic programs that would reduce the vast pool of unemployed people in Mexico that have weak resistance, weak resilience to being recruited by organized crime. That's a very valid, very important element of the policy. But it becomes really inadequate and extraordinarily bad strategy when this is the bulk or the entirety of the strategy. And this is essentially what has happened. So what we have seen is increasing impunity in the behavior of criminal groups. Really going back to the early spring, where Jalisco Nueva Generacion, the most vicious and aggressive cartel currently around, has repeatedly shot up police stations, killing police officers, has repeatedly attacked public security institutions, has burned down a casino in which some 30 people perished, 30 innocent people perished. Has taken other steps, and each time an incident like this happens, security forces do not react, and they specifically do not react because AMLO has instructed not to use fire, and after each of the security incidents, AMLO praises the security forces for not acting, for not responding with force. Now, this has, of course, culminated, and I would say that each of these security incidents building up to October, and I'll come to October, would have been enough, both in the Calderon administration and in the Peña administration, to have a different response, to really shift policy. So remember when in 2010 a party was shot up by one of the criminal groups in Ciudad Juarez, in which some 14 children die. It was a very defining moment in the Calderon administration. The outcry of against that event forced Calderon to devise the Todos Somos Juarez policy, to embrace a different element of his strategy. When the Zetas burned down the Monterey Casino, again, that generated very significant outcry and generated significant shift in response in policy. Peña ultimately was allowing security to deteriorate, to slide, and sort of was shoving under the rug the problems. But nonetheless, even he was in some ways forced to react to events such as the massacre of the students in Iguala, still not resolved. What's really been astounding is that in each of these events that should have been defining events, AMLO just continues with the same policy, continues significantly underemphasizing and even derogating law enforcement response, really sending the message that getting away with murder in Mexico is not now only a matter of lack of capacity, but it's actually an endorsed policy, which, in my view, is really a catastrophic message. So with this long build-up, then we come to October and the events in Culiacan, where the Mexican government, Mexican military, at U.S. behest, attempts to arrest the son of El Chapo, the most notorious drug trafficker now imprisoned in the United States, his son Ovidio. And, you know, this is an incident where the administration is clearly slipping to what it has disavowed, namely high-value targeting. But then in addition to embracing a old problematic policy in this one instance, it does so also in an extraordinarily botched manner. The tactical handling is a disaster against something that is linked to AMLO, particularly because AMLO prefers strongly the Army versus the Navy. The Navy has been the closest U.S. Partner, the ones that have received most vetting, assistance, training. So he chooses an actor that has less history, less experience, less capacity to conduct the raid. And the raid backfires with the Sinaloa cartel really shooting up Culiacan, taking families of the soldiers who attempt to arrest Ovidio hostage, and ultimately Ovidio is released in a very public manner. And the images from Culiacan, I was in Afghanistan when it was happening, really could have been a situation from Afghanistan. Just the explosions, the manner of the raids, it could have been a shot from Afghanistan. So, you know, terrible outcome, terrible debacle. You would think that at this point, AMLO and his administration would say no more. We had to let Ovidio go in order to save lives, but any cartel, Sinaloa cartel, that behaves in this way is now our primary target. We will tear them apart. We will not allow this kind of deterioration of security, this kind of brazen behavior. Once again, AMLO endorses abrazos, hugs, not acting. And finally, we come to the killing of the LeBaron family, and of course, again, the same type of messaging, now changed by the fact that the Trump administration is considering designating Mexican criminal groups, the cartels, as terrorist groups. I think that's a very problematic decision, and I hope that it won't happen, not because I believe that they don't merit the label terrorist, not because I don't believe that they don't have political effects. They might not have revolutionary ideology and want to take over the state, but they have profound political effects in Mexico. And they have political agendas, and they manipulate political processes and target local groups. But because that designation paralyzes U.S. foreign policy. So in Colombia today, after the peace deal with the FARC, we cannot buy ex-FARC combatants a cup of coffee because the FARC was designated as a terrorist group. In Nigeria, the United States can at maximum provide toys for children who were dragged off by Boko Haram, but only as long as the children stay in a facility, because even giving a toy to a child that was imprisoned by Boko Haram could be construed as material support to terrorist groups. So U.S. policy in terms of alternative livelihoods, all kinds of aid becomes really very hampered when a group is designated as a terrorist group. That's why I believe it would be a bad outcome if this designation happens. Nonetheless, I hope that the threat now will make the AMLO administration really think about how long they can persist with the policy of essentially abdicating law enforcement. The socioeconomic elements of the policies are important, but they cannot be the entirety. And as long as they remain the entirety, then we will only see another circle of hell in the insecurity in Mexico.
Thank you, Vanda. I have many questions, but I think we should press on. And so, Samantha, you know, one of the energy has become, well, as Roberta has just said, you know, make Pemex great again. Oil is and natural gas and other issues are high profile challenges in the country. And so, please tell us what we can think after the first year in office of López Obrador.
Excellent. Thank you, Chuck. And just to begin, in order to understand how the López Obrador administration is managing energy issues, it really helps to take a step back and look at the energy sector reforms that happened during the last administration and understand the conditions that brought these changes on. As Roberta implied, oil production is an important part of the Mexican economy, and Pemex, the national oil company, is considered a crown jewel of Mexico. But the crown jewel of Pemex, the Cantarell field, has been declining for some time, and there's been persistent underinvestment. And so oil production in Mexico is now about half of what it was during its peak in 2004. And the electricity side also faced some serious challenges. CFE, the state monopoly utility, had high prices, low penetration of renewables, despite the fact that the resources in Mexico are fantastic for renewable energy, and also an aging grid of infrastructure. So former President Peña's goals, they had two main goals in his energy restructuring, to bring in competition and to bring in capital. Competition was intended to bring in new entrants and break the sort of gridlock that Pemex and CFE had on the Mexican energy sector, ultimately contributing to Mexico's economy and lowering energy costs for Mexican consumers and businesses. And the industry also needed capital to keep up with growing demand and also to replace oil and gas production from aging fields. And I'll be very straightforward. Like the other folks up here, I actually very much agreed with the reforms that were happening in the Peña Nieto administration. And in fact, actually worked with that administration somewhat in a previous job at the U.S. Department of Energy. I thought that what he was doing there was good for Mexicans, opening up the sector to investment, ultimately was going to bring benefits to Mexicans and to the Mexican economy. But especially in the oil sector, these reforms were not universally accepted. And it helps to understand something about Mexicans and the Mexican psyche. Unlike here in the United States, oil resources in particular are really considered part of Mexican patrimony, something that belongs to all Mexicans. Actually, the day in 1938 that the Mexicans expropriated the oil industry is actually still celebrated as a holiday in Mexico. It's really important to people that the oil is theirs and belongs to all Mexicans. And so bringing in new firms to bid on Mexican oil fields and produce out of them was somewhat controversial. Also, ordinary Mexicans didn't necessarily understand some of the underlying challenges with the energy sector. Prior to the election in Mexico last year, we at Brookings, in combination with several folks in Mexico, including El Financiero, did a survey, and we found that the majority of respondents didn't know how much or even that Pemex's oil production has been declining. And so not only did they see these resources as really being theirs, belonging to them, but also they didn't really understand the underlying reason why it was so important to bring in new investment. So during his campaign, AMLO focused on a concept that he called energy sovereignty. This is very much his version of make Pemex great again, as Roberto said. The idea was bringing back the energy industry under government control and decreasing imported energy, particularly from the United States, in the form of fuels and also in natural gas. So as a result, many of the things that have happened in Mexico in the energy sector in the last year have been focused on taking back Mexico's energy and returning to this previous state-run structure, and I would argue with some questionable results. So the changes that we've seen have been particularly drastic in the oil sector. AMLO called a moratorium on auctions for oil exploration for at least 3 years, saying that he wants to see results from the previous bid rounds that happened under President Peña. But he'll be waiting for a while to see those results, because these were auctioned off as exploration blocks, and it takes a good 5 years minimum to go from exploring a brand new block to actually producing significant quantities of oil. So he could be waiting his whole administration to see the results from what happened under the previous administration. So the fact that those earlier auctions are not yet delivering results to Mexico is a surprise to no one. This is how this system works. It takes a while. And outside investment in Mexico's oil sector really has the potential to bring benefits outside expertise in the deepwater Gulf of Mexico, for instance, or also in unconventional oil and gas resources like we see in the southwestern United States. I have to point out that those resources don't come to a halt at the Mexico border. There are similar resources spreading into Mexico, but they're not being developed right now because Pemex doesn't have the ability to do those. That ability primarily is here in the United States. We have a world-class industry at developing that specific kind of resource. So there's tons of potential in Mexico, but Pemex doesn't necessarily have the money or in some cases the expertise to develop them by themselves. And also, Pemex debt has been downgraded nearly to junk status, and it's drowning in debt. So it's difficult for Pemex to come up with the capital to take advantage of the resources that it has. Also on the oil side, AMLO was really, really focused on the refining sector. And the reason why is this energy sovereignty idea. Last year, Mexico imported about 70% of its refined fuels, gasoline, diesel fuel, jet fuel, from the United States, and particularly from the large refining capacity that we have on the U.S. Gulf Coast. So AMLO has commissioned a new refinery on the coast in Tabasco, his home province, his home state. And he's also really focused on improving performance and upgrading existing refineries within Mexico. And if you think about this from an economist's perspective, you're like, okay, they're increasing the value add on the oil that they produce. Maybe this is a good idea. But on the other hand, I have to note that refining is a very high capital, very low margin, and also relatively low employment business. So modernizing those existing refineries, getting their production up, might be a good investment idea. But I think the investment in the brand new refinery in Tabasco State is pretty questionable. Adding on to that, AMLO says that Pemex can deliver this refinery for $8 billion within 3 years. Especially that three-year mark is very iffy. When he put this out to bid for international companies, they came back saying it would cost $10 to $12 billion and take 4 to 6 years. So vamos a ver how that will turn out. Finally, the retrenchment in the electricity sector is really harming Mexico's investments in renewable energy, despite what I said before, really fantastic renewable resources. AMLO's administration canceled what would have been Mexico's fourth clean energy auction, despite the fact that, unlike in the oil sector, the previous auctions had really delivered results. The first three auctions brought in 7 gigawatts of contracts for wind and solar. And in the last auction that took place at the end of 2017, the average price was just 2.1 cents a kilowatt hour, which at that time was among the lowest price seen around the world globally. So clearly these auctions had been successful. And it's really doubtful that CFE can itself achieve these kinds of low prices when it goes about building its own generation just because of the lack of competition. So instead of focusing on renewables and continuing these renewables auctions, AMLO's administration is instead focused on modernizing CFE's existing generation and even building new coal plants. This might sound like it makes sense. I talked about modernizing refineries might be a good idea. But the thing is, modernizing old coal plants compared to installing new renewables is a complete step change in efficiency, in environmental performance, in cost. I think it's clearly better for the Mexican public to focus on new generation. He's also changed the rules on Mexico's clean energy credits, allowing older hydroelectric plants to count and thus reducing the impetus for new renewable generation that those credits provided. So I'll wrap up my little energy spiel by saying that AMLO and President Trump are both populists, although they come at it from very different political directions. But I also think they see the energy industry somewhat similarly. They have really a view from the past. Their views on renewable energy are similar, and they have both focused on this idea of energy independence and energy sovereignty. As someone said earlier, things are not as bad as they could be. In fact, that's how I responded to Vonda when she first emailed me to speak at this. At least AMLO is honoring some of the old contracts that were in place. There were some questions during his campaign about whether or not he would do that. But I would say that his energy policies have been really more focused on politics and populism than they have been on what's best for the Mexican people and the Mexican economy. I think some of the previous reforms were actually helpful, not just from an economic point of view, but also from an environmental performance and a greenhouse gas point of view. And so I'm a bit disappointed with what we've seen happen in the last year.
Thank you. When I first came to Brookings a few years ago, I noted that Samantha is great at presenting solid research through great storytelling. And so it's nice to see that here today. Thank you. Tony. You're going to answer all our questions about the U.S.-Mexico relation and maybe the economy, too. I'd be interested if you agree with Vonda's comments about the her negative take on the Foreign Terrorist Organization designation for cartels.
Yes.
And so please, please go ahead. Thank you.
Okay. I also agree that things could be worse. They're not as bad as they could be in bilateral relations. In fact, as has been noted, many people predicted that the relationship would be much worse between the two presidents before they came in. Actually, the two governments have done pretty well to find solutions to take things forward despite tensions and serious disagreements in a number of areas. So I'll talk about three things. One is trade and investment, and thus USMCA. Secondly is migration and the border, and third is cross-border organized crime, which is a part of the broader crime problem, the part that touches the United States. So first, as you've all noticed, we're going to probably have a vote in favor of USMCA next week in the U.S. House of Representatives. This effort has been underway for a long time, not as long as many trade agreements, actually. Updating NAFTA to this USMCA actually took place pretty quickly in about a year and was finished before AMLO came to office, but he supported it. And then the last set of negotiations and amendments in order to bring on board Democrats in the House of Representatives and indirectly U.S. unions just took a few months and had a very intense last round over the past several weeks to deal with some Mexican disagreements with those proposals they initially received from the administration congressional negotiations. But they were actually able to come up with some creative solutions very quickly. Why does Mexico work so hard for this? Well, they sell 80% of everything they ship overseas to the United States. This is a tremendously important market. I think from AMLO's perspective, he wants to stay focused on his domestic transformation agenda. He needs income to do that. He needs tax income. He needs prosperity. And the way to do that is to assure that you have this continued market to the north. In the process over the past year, Mexico became the United States' number one trading partner. It's never been that before in modern times. Part of that's due to the disagreements with China and the reduced trade with China. But that U.S.-Mexico trade has remained steady even during this period of many other disagreements, which we'll talk about in a little while. And that's because the industries and the farm markets are very integrated. We buy a lot from each other, and we make more with each other than from the United States perspective, we make more with Mexico than we make with anybody else in the world, by far. It's not even close. Canada's number two, but Mexico is so far ahead of that. So this is an integrated market where both sides have a real interest in finding a way to have that go forward. The USMCA is not a perfect agreement. It does improve some things from NAFTA. It preserves a lot of NAFTA. It basically modernizes NAFTA to bring in a number of other areas, except in one section, which is the auto section, and then the things related to that, like steel and aluminum. And in that sense, this is we'll have to watch very much what the results of this agreement is going to be. A lot of experts predict it will actually make, for example, cars more expensive for all of you if you buy American cars because of the new requirements. Others argues that, well, that might be right, but it will assure more auto worker and steel industry and related industry jobs in the United States. We'll see as it goes forward. In any case, the overarching value of this new agreement is that it preserves and modernizes a marketplace that is in reality extremely valuable for all three countries in North America. It eliminates a degree of the uncertainty that has really tamped down investment across, especially between the U.S. and Mexico, but in both countries, and the uncertainty that might have continued for another year and a half until the U.S. could get through its elections and look at this agreement. So trade has been really important. And what we might see now is a return to a forward-looking trade agenda as we get into implementing the USMCA. And, for example, one part of that is the three countries would establish a competitiveness committee where they would look at what things could make North America more competitive in the world. We used to do that on a more regular basis. In the last couple of years, we have not had that kind of a forward-looking discussion between the three countries. So very important for all three of them. From Mexico's perspective, very important as they look to grow a number of their important economic sectors. Secondly, migration at the border. The numbers have steadily come down since June. There was an agreement signed between Mexico and the United States in June where the Mexicans committed to better control the flow of migrants from Central America coming north. Before that, and early on, AMLO had proposed to the United States that the two governments get together and invest in addressing the root causes of migration by investing in Central America and in southern Mexico. The U.S. agreed to that in principle, but not very much has happened in that area since that period. But what did happen was a focus that the United States asked for on enforcement on the part of Mexico. And whatever you may think about the migration policies of the United States, it is quite fair to say that Mexico did not have a very good migration policy, very strong migration institutions, very strong institutions to care for migrants as they came through. And they were essentially, anybody who got to the southern border could get to the northern border very quickly. And there were, in fact, a lot of organized buses that you just paid a bit on, got on, and went up to the Texas border. So there was, I think, a good basis for asking Mexico to be better about that. Numbers have gone down. They continue to go down, including the last numbers reported from the last month. In fact, further went down. What still needs to be addressed, however, in this whole migration issue is, are migrants being cared for as they are moving? What are the root causes, and can we start addressing the root causes? This really hasn't been addressed. And so even if you have some enforcement successes in this short term, are you really going to deal with the problem without looking beyond enforcement to the root causes? And then you have all the issues that are associated with care for migrants, respect for human rights, how they're treated, everything else that still need to be sorted out on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border, meaning in Mexico and in the United States. So that issue has been tamped down. There is a framework for discussing it, but it's far from being solved. Finally, the third big issue is cross-border security, cross-border organized crime. Vonda's analysis is an excellent analysis of the situation in Mexico. And from a U.S. national security perspective, you could say, look, Mexico wants to deal with its security policy, its security problems in one way, that's fine. But if it spills over into the United States, then that's our problem. And that's one of the things about the U.S.-Mexico relationship. We have shared problems and thus shared responsibilities for dealing with them. Right now, these organized criminal groups undermine the sovereignty of both countries. They're harming the citizens of both countries. The only way we're going to really effectively deal with, reduce that problem, and hopefully get it down to a minimal level at some point is if we start working together effectively. That certainly includes social programs on both sides of the border. The United States needs to deal with demand much more effectively than it does. Mexico needs to deal with its social challenges much more effectively than it does. But in the interim, you're living day to day. You need law and justice institutions that work. You need to be able to collect the intelligence on bad people that are doing bad things, arrest them, bring them to justice effectively, have them convicted. This is not easy. What has happened, however, over the past couple of years is that you've maintained a certain level of cooperation, but you have had no agreed overarching strategy between the two governments on how to tackle this. You still do not have an overarching agreed strategy of how to tackle this. That is essential, or you're going to see, I believe, more of these threats, for example, the foreign terrorist organization designation. We had a few months ago a threat to stop things at the border related to crime. What it reflects is this understanding gap in a coordinated plan, essentially of law enforcement, essentially of addressing the problems that are creating, from the U.S. perspective, creating social and human damage in the United States. My view is the best way to do this is to have an agreement so you can help both countries solve these problems. It is not going to be easy. We've tried to do it over many years. Over the past 10 years, there has been a more concerted effort by both governments to find ways to do that, which had mixed results but did have some good results. We've been sort of on pause in the past 2 years. The big challenge now for both governments is, can we move beyond this stasis and get into another phase of enhanced cooperation? And then finally, if we get all these three areas working together, as I mentioned earlier, hopefully we can return to the forward-looking agenda that we've tried to explore in the past, and that you can then get back to things that are more people-to-people oriented, that you're actually doing good things together in a variety of areas. And we just have not been able to effectively do that. Not saying good things don't happen, they do, but not in a way that's been sponsored in part of a framework by the two governments, because we've been dealing with crises and problems during this last period of time. So I'll stop there.
Thank you, Tony, very much. You know, one of the things that strikes me is what you're saying is, as somebody who spends a lot of time working on Central America, is that I believe that Mexico and the Mexican government has actually been vital, in helping President Trump actually deal with his policy towards Central American migrants. It's actually the release valve that's been crucial for success there. And the other thing, my impression is, I think that AMLO has actually navigated those waters actually more ably than I expected, as I think you mentioned. There's three questions I want to put on the table, and I'm just going to ask each of you to respond, and I hope that you don't respond to all of them, actually. So pick whatever one you want to respond to, and then we'll turn to the audience. And those three questions are these. One is, you know, the first thing is that AMLO came in with this expression, para el bien de todos, primero los pobres, and for the good of all, first, the poor first. What has he done? You know, how has he delivered for that? We haven't talked much about that in social policies. So he's expanded a lot in terms of jobs for youth, but it hasn't had the kind of short-term security impact that he hoped. So if you have anything to say on that. The second thing I'll say is, you know, I think I agree with you, Vanda, in terms of security, that the passive don't fight fire with fire and don't respond to these attacks on police stations by the cartels is not tenable and really a disaster. But what is the answer to that? And is it to go back to the high-profile you know, approach that we saw under Calderon, and what is it, like, what are the two or three things that you think would be most advisable in terms of dealing with the insecurity? Tony just shared his thoughts on that a little bit already. And the third question is, what are, if, you know, this is 1 year into a six-year term, what are the, if there, what's the one thing what course correction do you expect to see or that you think should happen, importantly, in this administration? So I'll just go down the line, Roberta, if you don't mind.
Okay. On the delivery for the poor, I think that's a really good question. I think the answer is, if you measure sort of the way the social benefits are being given out now and that they're going directly to recipients as opposed to going through intermediaries, right? So individuals now think that the money for the elderly or for childcare or for disabled kids or family members, that now doesn't go to providers for you, that goes to you. And I think that there's a real question as to whether that ultimately does better for people. I think it's a legitimate question to ask. But for sure, politically, it does better for you because you've now got an army of, I don't know, 8 million plus, it's more than that, who are getting their social benefits directly from, and he's very clear about this, it's not from the Mexican government necessarily, it's from AMLO and Morena, right? And that's going to serve him well in the next election. I will say that every business that I talk to that has sought to do the young people's jobs program, and there were quite a few that wanted to do hundreds of them, has been disappointed. They have ended up doing a fraction of what they had hoped to do, not because economically it's not viable, but because they can't get young people either who are qualified, and these are not, you know, very, very high-skilled jobs, but more importantly, they can't get young people who want the jobs and stay in the jobs, and that's very disappointing. The only other thing I wanted to say was on security. In my opinion, it's certainly not necessarily viable to return to some previous strategies that have failed, but my own view for quite a while has been that the strategies have failed in part because I don't think the high-value target strategy in itself was successful, because in the taking down all the capos or the heads of organizations, obviously what you did was fragment and actually increase violence, which can be an okay, not okay for the people who are living with it. But if that's transitional to a strong law enforcement capability and an extremely strong judicial capability, then maybe that's acceptable, that then reduces that violence quickly. That's not what happened. And so my view would be that you have to push much harder on the judicial implementation and creating strong judicial institutions that can judge people, that police and judicial institutions that can actually capture and judge people. But I believe very strongly that you have to deal with the cartels as transnational companies. If you want to get rid of Walmart, you're a competitor. When Sam Walton died, Walmart didn't go away. The same is true for a cartel. And unless you go after your financial infrastructure, the accountants, the safe houses, the product itself, and the customers, obviously, which is the demand reduction, but a lot of this is on the supply side, you need to go through all of the levels. And I think where they've made progress, they've done so when they've gone after the accountants and followed the money and done investigations that go at the structure of the organization at all levels, not just at whoever happens to be heading it this week.
Well, pick up on the security, endorsing what Roberta just stated. I mean, clearly the priority needs to be to strengthen the capacity of law enforcement, particularly police. AMLO follows Peña Nieto's suit in just dropping the ball on police reform. To the extent that he speaks about police reform, it's essentially increasing police salaries. That is important to the extent that police salaries are inadequate. People are susceptible to bribery, obviously, in addition to facing intimidation. But it's also not the entirety of police reform, particularly at the level of municipal police in Mexico. that has really been subjected to least police reform. Now, it's significant that we are meeting this week. It's significant because Genaro García Luna, the secretary, essentially minister in U.S. terms of public security under Calderón, and the man who was really tasked with conducting police reform in Mexico, was indicted in the United States and arrested on taking bribes from the Sinaloa cartel. That is an enormously significant event, in my view. You know, Tony and Roberta, you can chime in, but I really see this as at the level of earthquake in the trust of U.S.-Mexican law enforcement that really surpasses even the arrest of Gutierrez Rubio back in the 1990s, where this came after a decade of really very bad U.S.-Mexican law enforcement relationship and full expectation that law enforcement in Mexico was enormously corrupt. And so, you know, the Salinas administration, Kiko Camarena, enormously traumatic events and traumatic periods, Rebollo, the Gutierrez-Rebollo arrest followed then. But the fact that the architect of the anti-corruption police cleansing law enforcement reform at the level of federal police was indicted, I think it's very significant. And in my, I would posit that it will take quite a bit of effort now to restore the always precarious trust of U.S. law enforcement in cooperating Mexico, as absolutely vital as it is. And the AMLO administration has given little reason for resurrecting or strengthening the trust. In fact, is reopening, and has repeatedly, the president has repeatedly questioned Merida initiative that both of you worked on, and is a very important, very vital, very significant development. So police reform needs to be number one, and getting back away from the collapse in trust or the weakening in trust with U.S., is another one. The high-value targeting turned out a very problematic, counterproductive policy for Mexico, and I have long argued for different targeting patterns. One of them is middle-level targeting. Targeting is just a tool of strategy. And this is where the AMLO administration has thrown away the baby with the bathwater. In saying that a particular targeting pattern, in this case, high-value targeting, is problematic and counterproductive, one should not say that law enforcement does nothing, just watches lynching, watches murders, watches a city being blown up. And really the fundamental core issue for AMLO, as it was for Peña Nieto, as it was for Calderón, and as it has been going on to the 1980s, is how does Mexico get in a situation where law enforcement has deterrence capacity when it is feared and obeyed by criminal groups? Why does Jalisco Nueva Generación and Sinaloa in the United States behave radically differently than they behave in Mexico? They are flooding the United States with fentanyl. It's causing, in fact, flows of fentanyl from Mexico have surpassed flow of fentanyl from China. It's very much contributing to the greatest drug epidemic crisis in U.S. history, surpassing HIV-level crisis deaths. Really, really bad public health situation. But they're doing so peacefully. Nowhere the repeat of Culiacan. Why? Because our law enforcement has deterrence. This is what Mexico needs to resolve. There are elements to it. Judicial reform, judicial capacity is one. Police reform is another, a different targeting pattern. But the AMLO administration has really not grappled with that. And even as it has stated and states that its number one priority is to reduce violent crime and violence in Mexico, at the same time it says we will not go after drug trafficking groups, which is contradiction because the drug trafficking groups are not the sole, but they are certainly the primary source of violence in Mexico.
I'm going to step back from the security situation for a minute, given that it's not my expertise, and I'm going to focus on the first and the third questions. And as far as social policies for the poor go, I want to focus on the electricity policy that we're seeing right now and the move away from renewables. The head of CFE, the Mexican National Utility, has come right out and said renewables are unreliable and expensive. when actually what we're seeing right now is renewables are cheap. So not only is this move away from renewables possibly increasing electricity prices for Mexican consumers, if you think about this from an environmental justice perspective, it's everywhere and always the poorest people who suffer the most from environmental issues, be that a power plant, a factory, or anything else. And so this move away from renewables is likely to be most harmful for Mexico's poor. This is true the world over, and I'm 100% certain that it's true in Mexico as well. As far as a course correction, I'm not sure that this will happen, but I hope so. I think it would be good for Mexico. And that is that the administration comes to the realization that it can't do everything it wants to do for energy within the Mexican economy alone, that it needs investment, that it needs partnerships, that it needs outside technology. This is true in oil and gas, but it's also true in electricity as well. And so I hope there's a bit of a course correction in understanding that this isn't giving up energy sovereignty and that there is, power and cooperation, that a grouping of sources is often more powerful than just relying on your own. This is sort of an energy security idea that's a truism among people who think about this, but it doesn't always ring well with politicians. But I'm hoping that the inability to reach their goals and make the investments that they need for the Mexican economy has them pull back on this energy sovereignty and think more of strength through diversification.
Just on the social policies, I think Roberta hit the nail on the head as to why it is, in fact, popular. People are getting more money quicker, and that's why it's beneficial politically. I just note that on the youth for the job program for youth, I think they had to end it early this year because they ran out of money also to pay for it, which is one of the effects we haven't talked about, but one of the policies is austerity in the government, which means they've cut a lot of programs. They've eliminated a lot of positions, including a lot of their senior and most capable civil servants have left. So this has hurt the capacity of the government to implement in a number of areas also. On security, I agree fully with everything that's been said. It is vital that if you're going to go after a criminal organization, you look at the entire chain of its activities. In the case of those cross-border organizations, that means from where either they buy the stuff in a port coming in, or they make the stuff in a factory, or they grow it in the hills of Guerrero, all the way till it gets to Boston or Chicago and New York, and then where that money goes there, and then that it gets sent, how it gets sent back. And you have to go after each of those different elements. And that means you need effective intelligence collection, effective law enforcement, collection of evidence, bringing people to trial, cooperation on extraditions, cooperation on investigations, cooperation on tracking the money and the different patterns it follows. And that takes confidence, as was said. You have to have trust in each other. It's been a problem consistently. We've experimented with different kind of vetting mechanisms to make sure that you don't have moles in the group that you're working with. But it's a hard thing. And that confidence, I would say, has been weakened over the past couple of years for a number of different reasons, and it's going to take some time to rebuild. We should work at rebuilding it, and we should work at making these mechanisms more effective. And there's nothing that should separate that from working on other social approaches that you want to take to improve the long-term results for your society. The other course correction I just want to mention is I want to mention the zero economic growth this year. economic growth consistently, if you watch the predictions over the past year for Mexico, has gone down, 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 down. It's now maybe it'll be a little positive, maybe it will be zero, maybe it will be a little negative when we get the final results. Most of that is caused by Mexico. It's not due to the international situation. The United States is growing. Their trade has stayed steady. Remittances from the United States, somebody told me, I haven't verified this, but I'll repeat it. We're higher than they've been for a long time over this last year. So the problems are problems of lack of confidence and investment inside Mexico, other steps that have cut back domestic spending, especially government spending in the first part of the year because of the austerity measures, And so there needs to be a course correction there. The IMF came down and had a consultation. There were results published after that in November. They suggested a number of things the government should do to address some of these problems. Part of that, and this relates to what Samantha said, part of that is working with the private sector again. The government just announced an agreement with a number of big firms for a multi-year investment program to build infrastructure. That's very encouraging. That's the kind of investment you're going to need to have to get growth going again, to get domestic consumption going in Mexico to help spur that growth. And once again, it's really hard to carry out social reforms and pay for social programs if you don't have economic growth and you don't have sufficient income coming in. So I think in this area is where I would hope to see some course corrections. Thank you.
Excellent. Thanks so much. I'm going to open it up to questions, and please identify yourself, your organization. It's perfectly fine if you're here representing yourself. So I think Brad has a microphone and others as well. So yes, hands right here, gentleman up here in the front, and then gentleman to his left.
Yeah, thank you very much. Jose Diaz with Reforma newspaper from Mexico. The question is for the practitioners of diplomacy out in the field, right? And obviously also for Banda because of the nature. What's the security strategy that the U.S. wants from Mexico? Is it just one of stopping drugs at the border? What exactly is the Trump administration really willing to do? Because as you know, the State Department has a wealth of expertise on prosecutorial and judiciary reform in Mexico, but is that what the U.S. is proposing?
Can I take two or three at a chance? And there's a gentleman here to his left, and then this woman over here to
My name is Mark Gruenberg. I run a small news service for union papers here in this country. And I'd like to look forward a little, and particularly with the USMCA, and particularly to the U.S., to the two veteran diplomats here, which is give me a little bit of forecasting about what you see coming out of that, and particularly the specific... let me rephrase that. The chances AMLO has of implementing the safeguards and the protections for Mexican workers, which are very detailed, that are in the trade pact. He basically has to build a structure from the ground up.
Yes, I'm Dolly Esteves. I'm a Washington correspondent with different publications in Mexico. And my question is for Roberta and Ambassador Wayne. I wanted to ask you a little bit more about García Luna, because I know both of you work very closely with him, I think in both governments, under Fox and under Calderon. Did it surprise you what happened on Tuesday, that he was arrested and charged? And to what extent this represents an indictment of the so-called war on drugs? And it's pretty much like putting the chickens in charge of the fox and doing, or whatever the phrase is. Time out. Yeah, right. That's because he was in charge of going after El Chapo and the other cartels, and the other heads of cartels, yes. He was the one implementing the high-level target. So anyway, I like to hear your comments on this one. Thank you.
Okay. And the first question, what does the U.S. want on security? I have no idea. I don't know what this administration wants, what its priorities are on security in Mexico. We see episodic sort of implications of what they may have asked for, but it is not at all clear to me. We want more. We want tougher. I don't know what the strategy is on our side either. That's why I said neither side, I think, has a strategy. To some extent, each of us think we have a list of what the other one should do, but that's not a strategy. Okay, so that's my first answer. On forecasting on USMCA, I think Tony's a lot better at that than I am, so I'm going to let him do that one. I will say labor reform was underway before USMCA got got underway for negotiation. Obviously, it got ramped up significantly thereafter. It is so long overdue. And while it is unclear to me exactly how some of the intrusive things that were agreed to at the very end will work, and it is really unclear to me how successful all of these things are going to be, there is already a sort of a there's already an opening of the labor sector, unions thinking about moving into other industries where they didn't have organizing capability because they really couldn't. There was only one, you know, protection union, and a proliferation of actors in that. And certainly my hope is that adjudication of labor complaints and labor difficulties will be better, even if slow and probably nonlinear in how well it's implemented in the future. But I think it's very early days to say whether, you know, all of the things that have been agreed to will be fully implemented and how quickly they'll be implemented. Dolia, on your question on Genaro García Luna, the first question was, were you surprised? The answer to that question is no. Your second question was, is it an indictment in the war on drugs? And the fact of the matter is, I disagree with Vonda just a little bit on this, and I defer to her on a lot of security issues. But of the people that I know who worked with García Luna, there wasn't a huge amount of surprise, and I don't know that this will be an earthquake in terms of cooperation. I'm not going to say too much more about this, but I will just say it consistently reminds me of the last line in a very famous movie, Chinatown, in which the line is, "It's Chinatown, Jake." You understand the environment in which you're working, and you are careful, and you do as well as you can, but it does not mean that you always assume everybody you're working with is exactly as they present themselves. Let me leave it at that.
On labor and the future in USMCA, let me start there. There's a tremendous amount of work still to do. One of the big pluses that came out of the extended negotiation of USMCA was that the Mexican administration increased its funding for implementing the labor reforms. The first budget had hardly anything in there for labor reform, but because there was consistent questioning from the United States, they increased that funding, so that's good. But it's going to be really hard to do. They have to build a whole new court system, and they have to have elections in hundreds of thousands of workplaces. This is going to be messy and long, and there will be a lot of complaints. The new USMCA has a method for dealing with these complaints, which to me is going to be worth exploring. It's going to keep people really busy. If you read that annex, which you probably have if you're reporting on this, there's a lot to be done in there. It's not going to make the process any easier, but it is going to have thus extra sets of eyes on that process as it goes forward. On the U.S. security strategy, I agree. I don't know what the U.S. security strategy is, but my hunch is that from what I understand with people is there've been a consistent set of requests to let's sit down and try and work out a strategy together. And so there's an openness on the U.S. side to do that, and so far that hasn't happened. I would suspect that if what you would do is you'd come in, there'd be a set of different priorities. You'd try and work that through and come up with an agreed set of priorities. I mean, one area where the Mexicans asked for action recently was on arms illegally headed south. And the U.S. agreed to engage on that. We'll see how they engage and go forward. There are a number of working groups right now between the two governments sitting down and working through each of these issues. And so there's a basis there to have elements to pull together into a security strategy, but that has to be done yet. On the recent arrest, I agree with Roberta's request. No. But you know, it is sort of like Chinatown. There are a lot of people around being influenced on all sides by bad factors, by the temptation of money, by threats. And that's why you need really good and strong methods for vetting people and for checking out on a periodic basis, even though they were clean 6 months ago, are they still clean? And we do that in our law enforcement systems. I think we should ask that our partners do that also, and then we just try to do the best we can in moving forward. I would not be surprised if there were not in the future other arrests with people we have worked with very closely. That's just the nature of where we are right now. It's a tough game out there, but you've got to soldier on, in that British term, and keep fighting the bad guys and doing the best you can to bring them to justice and to stop the bad things you're doing. And you're going to run into corruption on the way. That's just where we are. Thanks.
So we'll...
June Bidle, Congressional Research Service. So I tend to agree with you, Vonda, but I'm looking at what are the costs to leadership in either country of non-strategy in terms of security, besides, I'd say, dead Mexicans and overdosed Americans. What are the costs politically of not having a security strategy when you've just, I think, delegitimized the top cop, got corrupted, obviously everybody knows about it, by the cartels, by one of the stronger cartels. So it's delegitimized after a long history of delegitimizing inside of Mexico. And then potentially, apparently some in the DEA did trust this leader, this security. You know, they at least said, you know, when I was working with him, I didn't think everybody was corrupt or that he was necessarily corrupt. So the point is that there may be a slowdown in some of the cooperation. So what are the steps and what are the costs of not having a strategy?
Hi, my name is Jordi Amaral. I'm a student from George Washington University. I was just wondering if I could get your take, particularly from Vonda, about the migrant protection protocol, as well as the great security threat that has been caused by that on the Mexican side of the border, how to tackle that, what you think about it.
Okay, great. I'll close it with that and turn to the panel. And Vonda, do you want to start with that?
Sure. So I am very glad to hear that Roberta thinks that it's not going to significantly weaken the level of trust that U.S. law enforcement developed in working with Mexico, because I think it's fundamental, and both countries need each other. Mexico needs U.S. cooperation in dealing with its security issues. So any kind of further weakening beyond the level of the presidents at the working level, at the state level, at the institutional level, it's very bad for Mexico. So to the extent that the shock is not such a shock, that's very good. That said, I do think it's significant that the architect, if the institutional reform in Mexico had one more positive element, it was federal police. And Genaro García Luna was very much associated with the federal police reform, and the U.S. was tremendously involved in that. It is very much true that the United States has agreed to operate in Mexico with very problematic vetting. So forever, when we build special interdiction units, which we build them around the world, as do other countries like the Brits, they are often the favored tool, often the only tool available, and they frequently go rogue. But nonetheless, when we build them, we tend to insist that every member of the special interdiction units has to be vetted. In Mexico, the United States has, over the past decade and a half, agreed not to vet, has agreed that the top officials on the units in Mexico will not be vetted. now because Mexico has consistently refused to allow the vetting of the top officials at the unit. So the situation with of the top cop being corrupted is a direct product of systems and signals that were sent and built and accepted and that should not have been there. And certainly the issue of repeated vetting is also not something that has been part of it and that badly needs to be part of it, as needs to be that everyone is in the vetting. Mexico should not be getting a pass on that. Now, AMLO has centered his policy on anti-corruption. Maybe here is an opportunity where the United States could say, okay, you want anti-corruption, let's start building special interdictions units differently. The difficulty is that the AMLO administration has not wanted SIUs at all. They have not wanted to do this element of policy. What the Trump administration has principally been requesting is stopping, other than the wall and Mexico paying for the wall as a security policy, is stopping fentanyl and heroin flows. AMLO has, the Peña Nieto administration has delivered tremendously on poppy eradication, well, tremendously in terms of the amount of hectareage destroyed. Although that has not really slowed heroin flows to the U.S., but they're doing eradication in the same way that President Duque is doing eradication. It's been harder for AMLO, but it has not stopped. AMLO has been delivering on poppy eradication, though not as much as Duque. But nonetheless, the flows keep coming, and fentanyl keeps coming. Fentanyl could have been the easy area of U.S.-Mexico security cooperation, vital for U.S., and AMLO has completely rejected that. For reasons that are not obvious, they don't cost him politically. It's the easiest element of cooperation and one that should be really meaningful and significant. On migrants, well, the consequence, of course, of stay in Mexico policy has been very dire conditions for people who are awaiting asylum cases in Mexico. The conditions, as Tony talked about, in the shelters are problematic, as has been U.S. policies of dumping them in some of the most dangerous parts of Mexico. We hear numerous stories of them falling prey to extortion, kidnapping, and worse by cartels in places like Nuevo León and Tamaulipas, parts of the country that are very very problematic, but in my view, still on the cusp of a second wave of security problems, which is when the Mexican public loses its patience with them and starts reacting to them with hostility in the same way that we're seeing in Brazil toward migrants from Venezuela or Colombia. I mean, some of it is already happening, and I fear worse will come, and then we will have double sets or triple sets of security threats to the migrants, not just from the criminal groups, but also from public that is now threatened by the by the pressure on the social environment that they put.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Just two quick things. One, I think on the security issue and stopping fentanyl and heroin, I think that's probably right. Vonda's willing to make that interpretation from what we've seen more than I was. I think one of the things to keep in mind is that the future is synthetics, right? The future isn't heroin and poppies. The future is fentanyl, qua fentanyl, right, which is now being produced in Mexico, and methamphetamine, which is the second largest. And so when you look at synthetics in particular, the optimistic news is maybe you can get away from geography being destiny because it's coming in from internet and other sources, but it's also easier to produce in smaller territory and smaller amounts. It's easier to smuggle in because of the profitability. So that ought to be the focus, I think, of the both administrations. The last thing I would say is I want to be clear about my comment on not being surprised about Garcia Luna. I don't want that to lead to a conclusion that it's okay. The fact that a policymaker may not be surprised by someone having been corrupt doesn't mean that you aren't disappointed and that you don't do everything you can to work with people who are not corrupt. But over the years, my experience has been that you make certain assumptions, and there are always lots of allegations, usually by the military against those in the police and vice versa, which you have to take both seriously and also in the context of the allegations. And you ensure that you rely on the people that you vetted the most heavily, because some are vetted through U.S. systems as leaders, not SIU, Special Investigative Unit chiefs, perhaps, by the U.S. They're vetted by Mexico. But you may recall in the end, Dolia, that it wasn't the federal police that caught Chapo. And I think that there was never an assumption that those kind of operations at the highest levels would be carried out by the police. There was always an assumption that they would be done by units within the military with which we had greater confidence from experience. So, I just have no idea. So, I mean, cabinet secretaries, it's not the same thing as somebody who's in a lower ranking position, operational position.
Thank you very much. And please join me in thanking our panelists for their presentation and their time. Thanks.